It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The American Heart Association estimates we consume around 60 pounds of added sugar each year. And they put it another way. That's the size of 6 bowling balls weighing 10 pounds each. We go deeper on the world's largest crop with help from a new investigative podcast series. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Celeste Headlee is a journalist and host of Big Sugar. It's a podcast from iHeartMedia and Imagine Entertainment, delving into the multi-billion dollar sugar industry. Celeste, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your podcast, telling the story of sugarcane production on American soil and through decades. Why is this story so important, so relevant to share today?
Well, the main reason is that the Farm Bill is up for reconsideration this year, which is a massive, massive piece of legislation most people don't pay a lot of attention to. And it only comes up for reconsideration every 4 years. And the sugar program is a multi-billion dollar piece of the Farm Bill. And so this is the moment when we need to reconsider the sugar industry and whether it's worth billions of our tax dollars.
What are the subsidies and the profits like for sugar growers? What's at stake in the Farm Bill?
So these sugar subsidies were put into place decades ago as part of the effort during the World War, when they were concerned that we might have to rely on sugar from other countries and then not have enough sugar. It has been obviously quite a long time since we had to worry about that as a nation, but the sugar subsidies are still in there, which basically guarantee sugar growers a certain price for the sugar. It incentivizes companies to grow sugar. So they are getting billions of dollars to grow sugar. As I mentioned, it is worth billions to a very small number of sugar companies that are owned by a small number of basically people, families in many cases. And yet, our sugar in the United States costs more to the American consumer than it does in almost every other developed nation. So taxpayers are paying for sugar in a number of ways, and I'm sure it will come out over the course of this conversation. We're also paying for it in healthcare and the environment, but just through the sugar program in the Farm Bill, our sugar is very expensive indeed.
You had aha moments throughout this investigation. What surprised you most after investigating the sugar industry?
I think, number one, I don't think I realized just how hard it is and always has been to get sugar to our tables. Mm-hmm. I don't think I really, really took that in. Hearing the stories of these Jamaican workers, you know, cutting sugar cane, which is mostly done now using machines in the United States, but it's still cut by hand in many other places. Hearing these Jamaican workers talk about what they went through, because American workers were not going to do it. And so these companies would bring in immigrant workers through our migrant worker programs to cut it, and them talking about what they went through, it was kind of horrifying, frankly.
Using machetes?
Yeah, they would be in armor because these machetes were so sharp that if you make a mistake, you're standing there in the hot Florida, Louisiana sun all day long for 8 hours, and you're expected to cut 8 tons of cane. And I don't know, Kate, if you've ever had your hands on a cane.
Mm. I used to live cane. In Louisiana, and there were
fields all around. These massive plants, right? Sometimes they grow way above your head.
Yes.
They are thick. Some of them take both your hands to get around them. They feel like wood, like they are thick. Mm. And so these machetes are incredibly sharp. They can easily cut straight through your flesh and into bone. They're wearing armor. It becomes this just rote robotic movement for these men. So you can imagine what that does to your body over the course of a day of doing this same movement. I mean, just the description of what happened and the injuries that occurred, and they would get short periods of a break for lunch where they would get maybe a bowl with rice and perhaps some beans in it. They didn't get a break for water. I just it never, you know, putting a spoonful of sugar into my coffee in the morning, I didn't make that connection.
We're talking about the multi-billion dollar sugar industry through the decades. Celeste Headlee, host of the podcast called Big Sugar. You can join in with your questions, share your concerns at 800-642-1234. Celeste, your podcast stems from the 1980s book called Big Sugar and a 2001 investigation by Vanity Fair. What has changed since these decades-old investigations? I mean, you mentioned technology changes, and you know, I would imagine too there are now, you know, sugar harvesters and farm implements that we're not having to do this by hand.
That is one thing that has changed, and at least in the United States, they are using sugar harvesters. The United States is one of the, you know, the top five producers of sugar in the world. The other four big producers, like China and other places, still often harvest by hand, though. Some other things really have not changed all that much. I got to be honest with you, much of the sugar industry is looks exactly the same way that it did 20 years ago, when Marie was writing this piece about the landmark court case, this massive court case in which these Jamaican workers were trying to get back the wages that were stolen from them, and they were not successful in doing so. You know, it's the sugar industry goes back obviously hundreds of years. It is not possible to separate the sugar industry from slave labor because it is so labor intensive. Even though the harvesters themselves has been mechanized, sugar is still a labor intensive industry. It still requires a massive number of people to work those harvesters, to get it to the processing plants, to get it into bags. Every step along the way still requires a large number of people, and that will continue to be the truth for a long period of time.
A research fellow you interviewed for Slate Magazine says the industry is similar to a cartel. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, that was a research fellow with the Cato Institute who called on the candy-coated cartel. I mean, obviously, that's not a one-to-one comparison. Yeah, you know, obviously that's metaphoric. But in terms of the fact that there's this massive amount of secrecy, that this is the power of this industry is Matt, that is incredible that they pull levers of power that I think most of us are not aware. Let me give you an example, and this is a story that we tell in the podcast that Marie Brenner told in her original Vanity Fair article 20 years ago. So when Bill Clinton was still president, at one point he was breaking up with Monica Lewinsky and telling her it was over. And he had told his aides he did not want to be disturbed, and he was in the Oval Office. And a call comes through on his phone, and he said, "I didn't want to be disturbed." And the aide says, "Mr. President, it's Alfie Von Hoole," who was one of the CEOs of US Sugar. And the president says, "I'll take that call." That's how powerful these sugar barons are, and they always have been. They have manipulated not just politics through the incredible wealth they use, but science, environmental policy, real estate. I mean, when you talk about a cartel, it's mass the influence on our lives, our labor policy, our wages, it's massive. It's incredible the way it has influenced the way that we live.
Celeste Headlee hosts an investigative podcast series. It's called Big Sugar, focusing on the multi-billion dollar sugar industry and the forces within it. You can join the conversation with your question, share concerns at any point. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sugar can be found in foods we eat every day, and a new investigative podcast examines the industry's political power, its treatment of sugarcane harvesters, and public health effects of eating too much sugar. You can add a question or share at any point in the discussion. Call 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Journalist Celeste Headley is host of Big Sugar and stays with us. Let's bring in Jane in Oconomowoc. Jane, hi. What is your question?
Hi, good morning. I lived in southwestern Minnesota for several years, and there is one crop there is sugar beets. And I'm wondering if you can speak to the influence of the sugar beet crop on the sugar industry, and if that has made any difference in workers and how they're treated. And because the cooperative in the city where I lived, the town rather, where I lived was the main employer.
Jane, thank you for that question. Neighboring Minnesota producing roughly one-third of all sugar beets in America. Celeste, what can you say there about the role of sugar beets?
Yeah, I mean, sugar beets produce a significant portion of sugar in the United States. I think somewhere around 35% or so, still over half, 65% or so comes from sugarcane in the United States. But, sugarcane producers don't have to worry about sugar beets because of the Farm Bill. Just to go back to that, remember, they are protected from any competition because our government literally pays them to plant sugar. It guarantees them a price for sugar. In order to force the sugar industry, Big Sugar, to have to compete in a fair market, we would have to kill the sugar program, which, this is one of the reasons we did this podcast this year, is to encourage people who want to have their voices known to think about possibly where $2 to $4 billion of taxpayer money could be spent if it weren't going to pay sugar barons to plant sugar. What other things could we spend that on, and call their representatives? Because yeah, they're being paid, so they don't have to worry about sugar beet producers.
Why is the sugar industry have so much political sway, so much savvy and pull in Washington? Why is that?
Because they're so wealthy. I mean, imagine for a moment that you have this product that everybody wants, right? And you're still also being paid to sell this product. And you're making money coming and going. They're very, very wealthy. They have a lot of money. And so they spread it around, and they're quite savvy politically in that if you go and look at the political donations made by many of these sugar producers, they're not donating to one party. They're donating very liberally, lowercase l, to both parties. And so they become important donors across the board. They don't just get a Democratic president on the phone. They get a Republican on the phone as well. They are important to both parties, to all parties. That's what makes them so very important. And so both of the political parties are willing to protect their interests. They also often make the case when it comes to the Farm Bill, they make this case that they are, you know, farmers. They make this sentimental appeal that, you know, we're American farmers and we should protect American farmers. And I would think most people don't, that's not what they think of when we think about, you know, a small time family American farmer, but they're quite good at making that case. So when it all comes down though to is just billions of dollars.
And then why is it, though, that sugarcane producing farmers get these subsidies, whereas in our parts where sugar beets are produced, those farmers aren't getting the same types of subsidies?
Yeah, it all just goes back to the origins of that sugar subsidy, going back to the war era when, there was concern that that was still at the time when we did not have an obesity crisis. They felt that sugar was necessary for energy that they needed to keep, not just soldiers, but all the people working on in the factories going. They needed energy. They needed to make sure everyone was working at their best. That required sugar, and they were afraid that they would run out of sugar. And so they wanted to protect that industry. They wanted to protect that commodity. And so they put subsidies in there to make sure that farmers would always have a guaranteed price for sugar. And it is a relic of that time, basically, because every single time the Farm Bill came up for reauthorization, the sugar producers would lavish donations on politicians and they would vote to reauthorize that sugar subsidies. It's still there.
Celeste Headlee, host of the podcast Big Sugar, you can join in with your questions about the sugar industry, 800-642-1234. Ernest in Hayward now. Ernest, what is your question?
I've read a lot about the subsidies of corn in the state of Florida that have polluted and caused destruction to the wetlands in Florida. And then there's the corn subsidies, too, giving us high fructose corn syrup, which is contaminated groundwater and our own health and groundwater in the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico through the use of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides. So, but Florida is really, really a basket case because of the corn subsidies down there.
Ernest, thank you. What are the environmental realities in growing sugar, in growing these crops, Celeste?
Yeah, it's pretty devastating to the environment, and it's partly because the regulations are not there. And again, this is because of wielding political influence to avoid having those regulations put on their industry means that the industry has been dumping chemical fertilizers and pesticides straight into the marsh. The Everglades have now been polluted by phosphorus, not just in Florida, but as you know, in Louisiana as well, nitrogen, mercury, that's caused some really devastating algae blooms. A lot of the natural plants and animals have died. There also is an incredible amount of air pollution. Why? Because the cheapest way to get rid of the stubs of cane is to simply burn them. So they burn almost 500,000 acres of sugarcane for 6 to 8 months out of the year. And there's a lot of critters that don't make it out that simply die in these fires. And so instead of doing a more environmentally safe way of refreshing those fields, they just burn them down because they're not required to do anything else. You know, part of the podcast, we went down and visited some of these fields. We parked at one point in an elementary school, and it was right next door to one of these sugarcane fields where they were burning. And I stepped out of the car, and in less than a minute, I was covered in this thick ash. And I looked to my right, and all of the playground equipment was just coated in thick black ash. Yeah.
How water intensive is this crop?
That's another thing. It also requires a great deal of water as well. You know, sugarcane, often if you go down to a sugar field, and again, you have seen this before, it sometimes is in standing water. And so for the environment, it is a very cost intensive crop in every possible way. The problem is that every single time people have tried to take even the smallest steps to try and put regulations on to force the industry to
adapting even sustainable,
tiny little bits, right? How they truck their products, how they transport things, It's been over tens of millions of dollars end up going, and then it gets defeated. There was an attorney general in Florida that filed a lawsuit, which I think is still ongoing at this point, which there have been lawsuits filed before. The Everglades Health Foundation has tried. They've tried through the Army Corps of Engineers to
multiple ways. Yes. Celeste Headley, we're going to pause here, host of the investigative podcast series Big Sure, looking at how industry practices affect our world. You can join in 800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Live from
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kay Darcher-Kent. The agricultural lobby, the American Sugar Alliance, it says sugar is an essential ingredient in our nation's food supply, made from two different crops we've been talking about, sugar beets and sugar cane. A new investigative podcast exposes harsh worker conditions in sugarcane production and the power of this industry. Call in with a question or comment at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Journalist Celeste Headley is host of the podcast series called Big Sugar. Celeste, we heard from Linda in Appleton who called in, and Linda is wondering about the pushback you received from the sugar industry because of this podcast. How did the American Sugar Alliance respond?
They had a couple responses. The first is they felt we were focusing on a 20-year-old case, which is true. Part of the story we tell is about a class action lawsuit that began 20 years ago. That's true. But we bring the story obviously up to present times. The other thing is that they talk about the number of people that they employ, that they're an important part of American business. What you just said, that sugar is a part of people's diets and they rely on us and they're a good part of American capitalist business. So all those things are true. They employ a lot of people. They are a corporate member of American society. No argument here.
Let's talk about the court case following lawyers who filed this class action lawsuit in the 80s over millions of dollars in lost wages for sugarcane cutters. And let's listen to lawyer Edward Tuddenham on his discovery that workers weren't receiving their promised wages.
You had to cut over a ton and a half per hour, and people just couldn't do it. People clearly were not cutting fast enough. They just couldn't, physically could not. I don't care whether you're an Olympic champion, you cannot cut cane that fast.
So what happened with this court case?
Some of the sugar producers settled. There was one sugar company that did not, and we focus on the two brothers that owned that company, two men born in Cuba who fled to the United States after Castro took over, the Fanjuls. And that ended up being a very long, drawn-out case. Essentially, in the first time they went to court, the judge immediately issued them a ruling in their favor, a massive ruling in their favor, and they appealed. And then it ended up getting drawn out over years and years and years. And in the end, well, I don't want to tell you that. Let people listen. but the workers don't get their lost wages. Let me just say that. And this is something that all Americans, frankly, we should feel ashamed for. I mean, these workers literally gave their blood to get sugar onto our tables, and we did not treat them well. And they were earning very, very, very little, and their employers stole some of that from them. But I think, one of the reasons we needed to go back to retell this case is because A, we needed to update it with what has happened since, but also it's really important to understand the sugar industry's place in labor history in the United States, its place in immigration history, because it really had a lot of influence on our government's attitude toward migrant workers and the policies that are still in place today. And, what happens? Because if one of those workers were not up to par, according to their employers, if they got injured, if they weren't cutting enough cane or working hard enough, the threat was always there that they would simply deport them.
Hmm.
That gave them an amount of power, which is just, that's a lot of power. But they also had them in just very dire conditions. The places where they were had them living and forcing them to pay for their food and these rooms. It was just awful.
The Von Hul family, the maker of Domino Sugar. And, I think about my own complicity. I mean, I put my sugar cube just a couple hours ago, my Domino sugar cube, into my Earl Grey tea. How do we reconcile with this, Celeste?
So I have not been able to. First I tried to go without sugar, and which was very difficult and over time became impossible for me. It's not impossible. And there's gotta be people who call in and say, I am now without sugar. And I tip my hat to you because it's hard. It's very hard. They put sugar in a lot of things. By the way, Domino Sugar is also CNH Sugar. It's Florida Crystals. It's Red Path. They own a lot of things. I found the Wholesome Sugar Company. They are not part of these big sugar companies. Hmm. It's really difficult. I mean, I think, the thing of it is, Kate, is there's so much in life that is when you pull back the curtain, there's ugliness behind it. And it's almost too much for your average human being to bear. And so it's impossible for all of us to have to bear that burden for everything in our lives. I mean, it's too much, but the time has come for sugar, right? Like there was a reckoning for tobacco. There's the beginning of a reckoning for this pharmaceutical industry, and it's time for sugar to have its reckoning. And we do have to bear this for a moment. It's time for us to think about how that sugar is getting to our table and to come up with a better solution.
Celeste Headley with us, host of the investigative podcast series Big Sugar, as we look at the multi-billion-dollar sugar industry over time. And you can join in at any point. Call in with a question. Share your concerns at 800-642-1234. Celeste, you were going here for just a bit, but Lynn from Wausau called in and is wondering if there are more ethical ways for us consumers to buy and use sugar. And Lynn asks, is beet sugar, for instance, more ethical to use than cane sugar?
No, it is not, I'm afraid. It also is not environmentally safe. Some of the companies that I've been talking about also own a great number of beet fields. You have to actually do the research on the company itself. I ended up tracking down, like I was talking about, the Wholesome Sugar Company,
mm-hmm.
which I'm a journalist. I don't know the people who own Wholesome,
mm-hmm.
but I did my own research on them. They launched in 2001 and they were a fair trade company. And they have consciously sourced ingredients that are also in keep an eye toward climate change. So you have to do your own research and find them. In terms of sugar, that's one of the few. It's not the only, believe me, but you have to do your own research to find somebody who is producing it in an ethical way, and it's gonna cost you a little more. You can try to replace it with honey. That's not going to work in all of your baking. But it's so hard. And the other thing about this that makes it so difficult is because the sugar industry has been remarkably successful in getting sugar into so many parts of our food items that it does not belong in. It's in beef jerky. It's in vitamins. It's in some toothpaste. It's in bread. It's in so many things. And if you think it's not, that's partially because there are so many names for sugar that you do not recognize. In fact, if you go and Google it, you will find people who have collected all the many different names for sugar that sugar has. And that is that those lists are dozens of names long because it's updated all the time. And I had to print those lists out and keep them in my kitchen when I was trying to eliminate sugar, because you will not recognize sometimes that sugar is in your food until you realize that it's named something entirely different.
Does the industry come up with those names?
Oftentimes they do, yes. And it's a way of adding sugar into these other products. You don't know the sugar is in there, but it is just sugar. And so you don't know that this is a Domino's food brand sugar that's in your sugar. And so you're buying a product from Alfie and Peppy Van Hool without even realizing it. It's so difficult. And it feels insidious.
Celeste Headley, journalist, host of a new podcast series examining the power of the sugar industry. Calling with the question, share your concerns, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new investigative podcast series examines exploitations in the multi-billion-dollar sugar industry through decades and the political influence sugar businesses have today. As we explore the podcast called Big Sugar, call in with the question, add a comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Journalist and podcast host Celeste Headley stays with us. Celeste, turning to sugar in the diet, consuming excess sugar can increase the risk of serious health conditions, including type 2 diabetes. How has the sugar industry marketed the nutritional benefits of sugar?
Well, much like we saw with the tobacco industry in terms of revelations about how they influenced the science, the same sort of revelations have occurred with sugar. Essentially, research has uncovered the fact that the sugar industry really impacted what we know about sugar, and especially its influence on our cardiovascular system. And this has been pretty recent. Listeners may realize this because for a very, very long period of time, the sugar industry pressured doctors to blame fat for not just obesity, but all kinds of cardiovascular problems, heart problems, and heart attacks. And so, you know, you'd go to the store and you'd see a box of licorice and it would say fat free. And so, you know, people would eat things with all kinds of sugar. I saw this ad for sugar that said, if sugar caused obesity, why are there so few fat kids? Because they eat so much sugar, right? One dentist that we talked to was researching sugar for a number of reasons. And she ended up finding the archives of a sugar company that had gone out of business. And, you know, a librarian had the archives of this sugar company. Nobody was really paying attention. These were all confidential documents. And so she found all these confidential memos in which there was all these, there was the receipts, right? It was these, they were revealing how they wanted to influence the medical and scientific information on the effect of sugar. But it goes back even further in with the story of two scientists, John Yudkin and then Ansel Keys, who basically kind of personify this battle between sugar and fat in terms of our health, in which John Yudkin, a guy who grew up in a very poor Jewish Orthodox family in Britain, was studying the effect of excessive sugar and found it absolutely led in a direct line to coronary heart disease. And Ansel Keys, whose research was being funded by the sugar industry, spent his life really trying to completely discredit Dr. Yudkin and succeeded in doing so. And Ansel Keys became a rock star scientist. He was on all the talk shows. He became quite wealthy. And since then, John Yudkin's research has been absolutely upheld. He has, since his death, been enjoyed his book, Pure, White, and Deadly, has enjoyed a second run of popularity, and it's turned out that he was right all along. So, yeah, for a very, very long period of time, our eyes were not opened to the danger of sugar, and now we know that we were eating too much.
You mentioned how the sugar industry had paid scientists in the 1960s to downplay the link between sugar and heart disease, and JAMA Internal Medicine had published those internal sugar industry documents in recent years, in 2016, really shifting the blame to saturated fat. Fast forward to the present, are there still issues now in influencing nutrition science?
Yeah, and I assume that what you're asking me this because of the recent report that came out saying that aspartame may be really, really dangerous. And of course, a large number of American scientists stepped forward immediately and said, absolutely not. There's no evidence for this. And many of them immediately said, we suspect the sugar industry is influencing this report. There was no evidence of this. Aspartame has been cleared again and again and again, but the truth is that every single time a sugar substitute starts to enjoy popularity, there is some sort of I hate to say fear-mongering. As a journalist, it always gives me hives to use that, but yeah, there's always some kind of fear-mongering brought up. And there's really not a lot of evidence showing that. For when aspartame first came on the market, there were some very sketchy research studies claiming that it caused cancer. And it kept a lot of people from using aspartame for a long time. And it turns out those research studies have been discredited and debunked. But because the reaction with studies, research that was funded in large part by the sugar industry was quick, incisive, and highly publicized. It worked its magic, and it made people wary of using aspartame. And there's always this concern when there's a sugar substitute that it's going to happen again.
Talking about the sugar industry with Celeste Headlee, host of the investigative podcast series Big Sugar. You can join in with your question, your insights, 800-642-1234. Celeste, in your reporting, did you see situations at all of any child labor violations? What could you tell us there?
I did not. We did not. Many of the places which you have seen recently reports of that happening were not the places where we were going. We were mostly in Florida, and like I, as I mentioned, the fields in Florida have been largely mechanized. So I did not. We had heard reports from people who have worked in some of the factories in which child labor has been an issue, but that was all secondhand.
in terms of the sugar that is imported then to our country? Should we be concerned about child labor in other countries as we eat the sugar? Because as you mentioned, this family, the Fanjul family, has sugar under a lot of different names and corporations.
Yes, we absolutely always have to be. The largest sugar producing countries in the world are the United States, as I mentioned, also Brazil, India, and Thailand and China. Sugar is a major crop, especially for Thailand, and that includes sugar produced from both sugar cane and from sugar beets. And yes, there is real issues for child labor in several of those countries. And there are a number of organizations, including the United Nations, that keep track of violations of child labor laws. And look, it's difficult for the average person to keep track of this. I don't expect everybody to do all this homework themselves. It's one of the reasons why, for me, I find it better to go and find the companies that are certified by an organization like Fair Trade Certified, etc., and let a certification organization that does that homework for you, an organization that you trust like that, let them do the homework, because, you know, life is hard. Most of us have too much to do already.
And that recipe calls for a cupful of sugar, meanwhile.
Exactly. I mean, if you're making something from scratch and that's why you need that sugar, let somebody else do that work for you.
As you watch Capitol Hill and the Farm Bill coming together and the tensions around it, what movement is there in removing sugar subsidies from the Farm Bill in the future? What do you see?
There has not been a lot. And, you know, this is one of the things where one of the reasons why we wanted to make sure that this podcast came out this year, why I have been doing as many interviews like this one as I possibly can, is to encourage everyone to call their congressperson, to call their representatives, because normally the Farm Bill gets talked about with these warm, glowing speeches about American farmers, and it gets rubber stamped. And so I would really love to see that not happen this year. At least let there be some debate about the sugar program and perhaps some of the other things that go into the Farm Bill. We're talking about a Farm Bill which all together includes trillions of dollars of taxpayer money. And again, we are in a period of time in which we're being told as taxpayers that there are some things that we find important and a value that we don't have money for. And maybe we should be thinking more critically and more intentionally about where that money is going.
Celeste, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Celeste Headley is a journalist and host of the investigative podcast series called Big Sugar. We have a link at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.